Do a little politicking?
I'll press your impudent son bitch.
You don't tell your pappy how to cut the electorate. We ain't one at a time in here. We're mass communicating.
Oh, yes. That's a powerful new force.
Mm-hmm. Think of it, Junior.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back here to The Full Story on WYAB 103.9. And it is finally here on Friday of this week. And again, what a crazy 7 days it has been. Starting last Friday with the ousting of the Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky from the White House, to the Trump's address to Congress, to a bunch of movements after that address to Congress. It's been just quite a bit of movement. Again, that's been the whole time, right? His whole time in office, just over 40 some odd days in office now. And it has been just a whirlwind of a time for the Trump administration. Like I said, like him, don't like him. Or don't like his policies or what have you. There is no arguing that he has been one active president and one active cabinet in the last month. And hopefully the Congress catches up and getting these policies passed through. Obviously, there's only so much the president can do on his own, but he's done quite a bit on his own so far. He promised people he would start day one, and that's what he's going to do. And that's what I want to talk about today. Two of the big stories that I want to cover this morning is, one, I want to talk about the stance on Hamas and Israel that was briefly talked about during his his speech to Congress. But also, I want to focus on a recent Gallup poll that's showing where people are as far as their support of Israel or Palestine, and what the shifts are, or if there are any shifts, I should say, in people's perceptions of the sides, as well as the breakdown between who believes what, who supports Palestine, who supports Israel, And I think too, it's we'll talk about this when we get, I guess, to the story, but a little disingenuous on the thing, Palestine and Israel, even though the war is not between Palestine and Israel, it's obviously between Israel and Hamas. And Hamas is, if I said, if you support the Palestinian people, then you have to not support Hamas, right? As they have wrecked their people and put them in such a horrible situation. Of course, I don't feel too bad for the people in the Gaza Strip, because they apparently still want to vote for them and still want to support them. And if you support them, then you're just as guilty as they are. But the Palestinian people as a whole is something completely different. But we're going to talk about that. I also want to discuss this whole idea of tariffs. What's going on with them? Obviously, Trump has talked about in his speech about increasing those tariffs or putting them on. And then there's been some changes, and then some pauses. And we want to talk about where we are on that and what's going on with it as we continue to cover the tariffs that again, Trump has been shown that he's not afraid to do. Again, just talking about generally the future of those tariffs, the direction of those tariffs, reaction to the tariffs as well. As always, we are live on Rumble and YouTube. You can find us on there, as well as on our website, regulatorsproductions.com, where you can find all the links to those things on there. And if you want to call in, you can call in during the break at 601-879-0002. But we're going to go ahead and take our first break right here. When we get back, we'll go jump right in to the Israel and Palestinian, and the poll that I was talking about there. So again, keep it tuned here to The Full Story on WYAB 103.9. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back here to The Full Story on WYAB 103.9. So yesterday, we spent most of the show talking about the movements with Ukraine as far as what Trump has done for that. Obviously, he campaigned on the fact that he is going to end the war. I think he says he's going to end it so fast in typical Trump fashion. We covered his speech to Congress on that, and then kind of the aftermath of the letter that Zelensky sent to him to get him to essentially say, hey, we want to sign the deal, and his discussion with Russia. And we talked about all that in detail. So now I want to move to the other war that's going on, another one that Trump said he would end, which is the one involving Israel and Hamas. Now, again, you can't get any really different types of conflict, right? Ukraine and Russia is dealing with two actual sovereign countries that are fighting each other, one that invaded another sovereign country in Europe, and involving two countries, neither one of which is an ally. It's a completely different situation than you have in Israel, which is essentially an ally of ours in the region that is fighting a terrorist organization that committed a atrocious terrorist attack on them. The tactics are different. The people they're dealing with is different. With a country, when you're dealing with a conflict that's dealing with two sovereign nations, there is typically you can typically negotiate with a sovereign nation. You can talk with them. You can try to figure out a path to peace. And a path to peace for that is typically not both sovereign nations are typically going to still exist at the end, right? Territories may change. Leadership may change. Different postures may change at the end. But the two countries themselves will still be there. As much as people hate the fact that Donald Trump wants to end the Ukrainian conflict, there is no ending that the United States would accept where Ukraine is no longer a country, right? That's just not going to happen. Ukraine has no interest. We don't get anything out of that, right? With the minerals deal, at least we get something out of it. And for that, we need Ukraine to be a country for us to sign a deal with. There's no ending where Russia is obviously not a country, right? There's no ending where there's some kind of full-scale invasion on Russia and then Moscow is flying a Ukrainian flag, right? That's not going to happen either because of the fact that it's Russia. As I said, despite the fact they are horrible fighters, it's a very tough country to try to conquer, and no one's yet been able to do it. Even though they have given some good college tries, Europe has, to conquer Russia or the former Soviet Union, hasn't worked for them ever. So that's a completely different conflict than what we have in Israel with Hamas. Like I said, here we have a sovereign nation, Israel, fighting a terrorist organization, which is Hamas. Now, there is the Palestinian people. Right, and I've gone on the show at length about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian kind of question, I guess, if you will, going all the way back to the founding of Israel back in the 1940s, and how there was initially a two-state plan back in even the 1940s that the Palestinians just didn't want. The Palestinians never wanted Israel to exist, and therefore they have never gotten the two-state. If they would have just agreed to the plan that was originally set back when Israel was still a British mandate, if they would have agreed to that way back then, they would have had a state back in the 40s. But they couldn't do that. And so therefore, you have a sovereign nation, you have a terrorist organization, and then you have a group of people, right, that are semi-autonomous. But they're not a sovereign nation, right? And when you hear people talk about two-state solution, right, that's what they talk about, is they want Palestine to be a state. But again, that's not what we're dealing with right here, right? We're not dealing with whether Palestine should be a state or not. We're dealing with the fact that these brutal terrorists kidnapped innocent people. We're not talking soldiers, right? We're not talking We're not talking some kind of Israeli government officials. Most of these were just straight civilians, women and children, a big part of it. And they have killed thousands and then mutilated others after kidnapping them, returning bodies in poor, poor states, have been dead for a while. Just really, really bad things that's been going on. And again, I always say, you know, you imagine if you're the United States in that, you know, if this, you know, we remember how we reacted after 9/11, right? There was nowhere those terrorists could hide from us after September 11th. Again, that dragged on more than it should by the end. But the very beginning, when we were out for revenge, you know, even the whole world just kind of backed off, right? And just let America have her revenge. And because there's nothing more than Americans like than a nice revenge sandwich. And we took some really good bites out of that one. Just, again, there was no negotiating with them, if you remember, right? President Bush saying, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And not only that, but if you help the terrorists, you're just as guilty as they are, and we'll kill you as well. It was a very strong stance, a stance that the Americans wanted at the time, and a stance that's needed with terrorists, because they only negotiate with a rifle, right? Or with a bullet. Or with a sword, whatever you want to say, right? Insert metaphor there for warfare. That is how they understand. That's how they negotiate. And so that's, like I said, it's a completely, completely different type of conflict. And again, also to the effect that Israel itself is an ally of the United States, has been for a while. Obviously, we spend a lot of money in Ukraine, I mean, in Israel, and you can debate the necessity of that, but we actually have some kind of skin in the game over there, much more so than we ever did in Ukraine. Ukraine obviously being a former Soviet country, and it was a Soviet country until the until what, 1991. So a completely different type of atmosphere and posture that we have towards Ukraine as well versus Israel. And now on Wednesday, President Donald Trump issued a stern warning to Hamas in a Truth Social post, calling for the terrorist group to release all the remaining hostages immediately. The post came after Trump met with several former Hamas hostages who traveled to Washington, D.C. this week. The group included El Sharibi, Doran Steinbacher, Keith Siegel, Aviva Siegel, Nama Levy, Omar Tove, E.R. Horn, Noah Argami, according to the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. The post began with the Truth Social post said, "Shalom Hamas," which means hello and goodbye. You can choose. Release all of the hostages now, not later, and immediately return all of the dead bodies of the people you murdered, or it is over, all caps, for you. Only sick and twisted people keep bodies, and you are sick and twisted. Trump added that he is sending Israel everything it needs to finish the job, and that not a single Hamas member will be safe if you don't do as I say. "I have just met with your former hostages whose lives you have destroyed," he added. "This is your last warning. For the leadership, now is the time to leave Gaza while you still have a chance. Also, to the people of Gaza, a beautiful future awaits, but not if you hold hostages. If you do, you are dead. All caps, make a smart decision. Release the hostages now, or there will be hell to pay." And that last sentence, again, in all caps. He loves the use of all caps. That's one of his one of the classic Trumpisms of using all caps. That and saying beautiful. It's gonna be so beautiful when he's done. He's gonna end it so quickly. You know, those are all the things that he likes to say, as well as add full caps of things. Interestingly, John Fetterman, the Democrat from Pennsylvania, the other one who likes to wear hoodies, and has been an unflinching supporter of Israel, offered his approval of Trump's post. He said, quote, "Free all the hostages or start killing Hamas members again. I fully agree with POTUS, is what he posted on X. This is, again, all of these movements. He met with Benjamin Netanyahu at the Oval Office just last month, one of the first people he brought in there. Obviously, the relationship between Donald Trump and Israel is also much, much different no love lost between Trump and Zelensky, but that relationship between him and Benjamin Netanyahu could not be any different as far as the warmth. Obviously, there's a great level of respect for Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Again, that's just something that is completely a different relationship than he has ever had with the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, especially considering Zelensky took money from Biden and not the cleanest individual. I'm not saying that Benjamin Netanyahu is, you know, not corrupt, because there's definitely been some, there's been some interesting movements that he's had as the leader of Israel. Overall, the relationship between him and Netanyahu is in a lot better position. Now, this is all coming as a recent Gallup poll has shown that less than half of people in the U.S. Are sympathetic towards Israel. So the poll, which is done by Gallup, and like I said, the key thing is anytime we look at these, we look at these polls, is we have to look at the methodology, and I talk about that a lot. So before we even get started into these numbers of the poll, which was mentioned several times by different people, different news agencies. Sorry, I had a sneeze almost coming in there. So I have to look at what it is. So this is a poll of 1,004 people. So not a very large poll. Not a large poll at all to say Americans, right? And they polled people, they allegedly polled people, all adults ages 18 plus living in all 50 states and DC. So, I mean, that's not a lot of people per state, right? That's what, that's 500 people. I mean, that's 50 people per state, right? Something like that. I'm not good at math. And obviously the states are going to, it should be skewed towards population, centers. So, you know, not a large, large poll going on right there. They said it has a 4%, margin of error. And they split those two, 503 to 501, on two separate different polls. So the number is even smaller. So the idea when they put out these headlines that less than half in U.S., you know, is the headline that we'd heard yesterday from a lot of the liberal media news outlets, you know, that less than half of the U.S. now supports Israel. Well, again, if less than half means, 400 out of 1,000 people they apparently randomly polled, then, you know, you take that for what it's worth. But just some interesting things that came from it. Just looking at the separation between sympathies towards the Israelis, Palestine, both, neither, or don't know, was another one. It's what's interesting to me is so you have the total number, and then I like it. I just like seeing it separated based on different demographics. But again, it's right now. Again, the question is: are your sympathies more with Israel or more with Palestinians? All right, so. They say less than half, right? Again, I'd like to also, too, you know, that's the headline from Gallup who did it. So that tells you a little bit there that there is a little bit of bias, because if you look at the numbers too, they say less than half. They meant that 46% of people have a sympathy towards Israelis, and 33% have a sympathy towards the Palestinians, which is, again, so more people still have sympathies towards Israelis than Palestinians. Now, again, that has the sympathies towards Israel has steadily dropped since about since 2020, when it was at 60%, and it's steadily been rising for the Palestinians. So you can see that based on, again, on this polling of 1,000 people in all 50 states. But again, so we start to break it down. So 52% of males versus 40% of females are favorable towards Israel, which is interesting to me, right? That's why there's a that's not a small gap, and it's 27% sympathy for male to Palestinians versus 39%. And I don't know if that's because they see the females see, you know, they've been displaced, and the males see it more as, well, they kind of caused it on themselves by, you know, kidnapping all the hostages and voting in for that group and then continuing to vote in for that group. Very interesting to me. Now, among college graduates, this is, interestingly enough, it's almost split between 40% for Israel, 39% for Palestine. So pretty much an even split there, which is an interesting interesting kind of group that college graduates are about even with that. Like I said, and that's coming after all of these protests that we saw on these campuses, that we saw on these campuses regarding Israel and essentially the anti-Semitism that was going on in a lot of these campuses. Not, I'm not to say, right? I don't want to put out, because sometimes I think anti-Semitism is overused, sort of like the race card is used. Just, you can disagree with Israel without being an anti-Semite, right? Don't get me wrong, but there was some definite stuff of just people's hatred for Jewish people overall. And this is coming after the DOJ is looking into anti-Semitism at the University of California under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's the federal task force to combat anti-Semitism, that they opened a civil pattern or practice investigation into the University of California. It will assess whether UC has engaged in a pattern or practice of discrimination based on race, religion, and national origin against its professors, staff, and other employees by allowing an anti-Semitic hostile work environment to exist on its campus. So Attorney General Pam Bondi said, quote, "The Department of Justice will always defend Jewish Americans, protect civil rights, and leverage our resources to eradicate institutional anti-Semitism in our nation's universities." Acting Assistant Attorney General and Department of Justice Chief of Staff Chad Mizell said, "Our country has witnessed a disturbing rise of anti-Semitism in educational institutions in California and nationwide. The Department of Justice is committed to upholding Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and protecting Jewish Americans as we investigate this potential pattern of discrimination." So, a pretty big, like I said, investigation. And again, I think, again, the craziness that we saw the last year, right, after the, especially after the October 7th, 2023 attacks, the rise in those type of just craziness of people openly supporting a terrorist organization blew my mind. Like, I get it. You don't have to like Israel, but to openly support someone like Hamas, like, what are you doing here, right? Like, I get it. You don't like Jews. You don't like Israel. You think Israel's big bullies, what have you. But have you seen how these people treat their women? That's what surprises me a lot about, you know, the women having more sympathies towards Palestine, is that are they actually aware of what Palestinians do with women? Because they don't have any rights, right? It's not like Israel where women can live freely. They don't have to wear things over their heads. They can wear bikinis at the beach, right? They can live their lives. They can drive cars. They can have jobs. They can decide to not submit to their husband. And he, you know, there's a thing called spousal rape, things that don't exist in a place that like the Gaza Strip that runs under strict Sharia law. So I don't know if they're aware of those situations, because my thing is this: if you want to be a so-called feminist, you can't be a feminist and be a supporter of Hamas or supporter of larger, you know, the Muslim world or any of those that support Sharia law, because by themselves and by their existence, they are automatically opposed to each other. But again, we've definitely seen that rise. But even more interesting, and I think no one would have seen this, no one would have seen this, you know, 20 years ago, is this shift of Republicans supporting Israel more than Democrats. So according to the Gallup poll of, again, 1,000 people in 50 states, 75% of Republicans have more sympathy towards Israelis versus 10% of Republicans to Palestinians, whereas Democrats are not quite the inverse, but 59% of them have more sympathy towards Palestine and 21% to Israel. So, you know, the crazy thing about that, again, you know, Jews have been such a force in the Democratic Party in the past. They have been largely Democratic voters, have supported Democrats for decades. And then, you know, all of a sudden they don't, now they're no longer supporting real, they don't really support Israel. So obviously, I don't know if you have, the more, you know, liberal, Jews out there, the ones that don't really, they're Jewish, or some people would say Jewish, right? They're Jewish by, family tradition or familial lineage more so than religion, anymore. They don't really go to synagogue or anything like that, versus maybe your more conservative Jews, and Orthodox Jews who are obviously, pretty big followers of the faith, versus those who are just, like I said, Jewish in name only, Jewish by association, not Jewish by religion. And maybe there's a difference there, because like I said, the support also of Republicans to Jewish people is very interesting to me from a demographic standpoint, and from a poll standpoint. And I think with a lot of Republicans is that what they see in Israel, they see a small country that literally is surrounded by enemies, right? They have no one really around them that is very friendly to them. And people, Americans and Republicans, they like a good underdog story, right? David versus Goliath. Now, it's not really David versus Goliath when they're fighting Hamas, right? Because Israel is so overpowering to someone like that. But you put in the fact that they're right there, you got Iran there, and all of those Middle Eastern countries, they fought with Egypt several times. Of course, interesting thing with Egypt, we give them billions of dollars too militarily, funny enough. One of the biggest receivers of military aid, mind you, is Egypt, from the United States, funny enough. I think a lot of Republicans just like a good butt kicking, I think. And Israel does a pretty good job of the butt kicking. And we've seen that time and time again, as long as we just let them do it, right? As I said before, we don't need to necessarily fund Israel's war. We can definitely do intelligence sharing, lessons learned, and provide support for them in a diplomatic standpoint, in that, hey, we'll back you up at the United Nations, right? We'll back you up with the Security Council. As long as you don't start committing genocide of people, right, we will back you up. Now, they have actually accused them of genocide, which is kind of ridiculous. But if you want to destroy Hamas, we'll give you two thumbs up. We'll say have fun with that. No notes from us. We'll protect you on the international stage. That's where we can help them. Versus, like I said, you know, not putting boots on the ground, not necessarily funding it any more than we have to. It is good to have an ally there, though, right? Because they are, in fact, an ally. Like I said, which is completely different from Ukraine. We do get something back from Israel in that we have that power force there in the Middle East. We have that ally in the Middle East. So we get something. It's not completely one-sided. Like it has been for Ukraine this whole time, right? With Ukraine, it's been giving billions and billions, no accountability whatsoever, and it's a war they cannot win. Israel can easily defeat Hamas. People just have to stay out of their way. And that's the kind of support that we can give them. And again, I think people have to understand, too, is that, you know, this idea of a Palestinian state, this two-state solution, while I think is great in theory, I think in a perfect world, there should be a two-state solution, right? There should be a Palestinian state and an Israel state. And if the world was perfect, it would have already happened. It would have happened way back in the 1940s when all of this was proposed, right? But the Palestinians can never accept it. They can never accept Israel as a state. And as long as Israel exists, there cannot be a two-state solution. And that means, well, if one doesn't exist, there'll never be a two-state solution. And that's just, I think that's the hard fact. I mean, like I said, it's really horrible that the Palestinian people have leaders that take such hard stances against Israel, and they have leaders who want to wipe them off the face of the earth. And if you have leaders who want to wipe one set of people off the face of the earth, well, you can't really have a two-state solution, can you? Right, those two people literally cannot coexist. They are mutually exclusive, about as mutually exclusive as you can get. They cannot live together, and therefore, this idea of a two-state solution is not a thing. And again, that's what Donald Trump talks about: is like, you know, move the Palestinians out of Gaza, let Israel occupy it, and bring it into the 21st century. And that should happen for all of Israel. Because, again, whether you like Jews, whether you like Israel, what have you, there is no question that Israel, as a country in the Middle East, is the best-run country in the Middle East, is the one with the most freedoms. It is a modern, Western-style country over there, the only one that exists. It's the only one that women can walk around without fear, where they cannot do that. They can't even do that on the other side, right, in the West Bank. They can't do that. But they can in Israel. And you see these gleaming buildings and these modern things in Tel Aviv. And you see the third world country that is the Gaza Strip, right? It's just jarring to see how a country can run. And again, the Palestinians may not like it. And I get it. It's their land. They've been there for 1,000 years as well. But at a certain time, people get conquered. That's the way the world works. Israel itself, it's funny enough, right? If we look, I'm already over time here, but just looking at the history of Israel itself, right? Going back to Jesus's time, it was not controlled by the Jews, right? It was not controlled by the Palestinians. It was controlled by Rome, right? And it was controlled by Rome for a long time. And after that, it was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Right, a Muslim country, and again, these Ottomans, the Ottoman Empire, were not Palestinians. They were Turks, right? They were Muslim, but they were not Palestinians. So this idea that it's their land or what have you—that's kind of an artificial concept, because that land has been conquered and unconquered by so many different people over the last 2,000, 3,000 years. It's nothing really to say that anybody has any right to that land. Who has the right to it? based on, if we're going to look at history, who has the right to it is one of the most military might, because that's who's controlled it in the past. Is whoever has the largest military might is the one that controls it. And that's what needs to happen again. And, you know, I get it. You know, the Palestinian wants to self-govern, and maybe they can get people, you know, in the Israeli, you know, Senate or whatever they call it, the Kishmet or whatever. I can't remember what they call it. They call it something. But it's going to be better for everybody as a whole, and it's going to be a safer region as a whole if it finally just gets united as one large country under the flag of Israel. All right, we're going to go ahead and take another break right here. When we get back, I want to talk about the movements in the Trump tariffs. You want to call in during the break, number 601-879-0002. Keep it tuned to the full story on WYAB 103.9. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back here to the full story on WYAB 103.9. Sorry that the music there kind of combined two of them, and it kind of threw me off as I was trying to get to it. But when Donald Trump made his speech to Congress, he said this about tariffs when he first began.
America rich again and making America great again, and it's happening, and it will happen rather quickly. There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that. It won't be much.
So I just wanted to play that little piece because he talked about a little disturbance. I think at the time he was talking about the fact that it's going to be, as I said before, with tariffs, it's kind of tough. Tariffs are initially tough on the country, and they're a long-term solution with a short-term, a little bit of short-term pain. And now there's been a lot of back and forth with the tariffs since then. He initially set a deadline of, was it Wednesday, that he's going to do it. And he has exempted more and more things from it since then, and he has signed orders significantly expanding the goods exempted from his new tariffs on Canada and Mexico that were imposed this week. And it's the second time in 2 days that Trump has rolled back his tariffs on those imports from Mexico and Canada. And on Wednesday, he said he would temporarily spare car makers from the 25% import levies just a day after they came into effect. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum thanked Trump for the move, while Canada's finance minister said the country would in turn hold off on its threatened second round of retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products. And I just, you know, this whole idea of retaliatory tariffs is kind of irks, is just kind of, it's like, oh, Trump can't put tariffs, but we can, and we're going to do retaliatory tariffs. It's like, okay, fine, do whatever you want, man. Like, they act like they're trying to threaten us or something, and that's what I'm not a big fan of, because you try to threaten us, that's me. Okay, I want to tax you 50%. Don't mess with me, man. You know, and Canada wants to pull, like, they want to act like they're some kind of big time thing. We're going to cut energy off to Michigan. Okay, fine. We want to bring the energy back here anyway. That's exactly what we're trying to do, idiot, right? That's the point of the tariffs. But again, this is part of it, right? As we try to figure out what's going to help us. And again, to give people time, like the car makers, to invest back into the United States is something that is needed. And again, something that we have to, I think it's good, right? It's not just saying, hey, I'm going to stick to my guns. We're going to do this no matter what. We're going to do this. We're going to do it in a measured way, though. We're going to do it in a way that tries to limit how much short-term pain the Americans feel while, again, still looking for that long-term goal. And again, that takes discipline, right, to do something like that. And I think it's good that we can see that, hey, we're gonna maneuver as time things. We're not just set in our ways and we're not going to do it. We're going to do it this way or not going to do it this way. We're going to kind of look at both ways and look at different ways and try to go with the best solution. And so people act like, oh, look at Trump. He's already backing down. We knew those tariffs wouldn't work. No, that's not what's happening right here. Right? What's happening is they're being smart. They're looking at the best ways to roll out these tariffs instead of just being a hardliner one way or the other. There are times to be hardliners, like on Ukraine or wars. Other times it's time to be, hey, let's be able to pivot and be able to adapt to the situation, which I think is an important thing to have. All right, we have to take our last break right here. When we get back, we'll do This Day in History, but keep it tuned to the full story on 103.9. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back here to The Full Story on WYAB 103.9 as we get to this day in history. So on this day, March 7th, 1933, Charles Darrow applied for a trademark for the game Monopoly, a game that would soon become a worldwide sensation. However, it started a little bit earlier in 1904. An American woman named Elizabeth Maggie created the Landlord's Game, designed to teach players about economic inequality and the dangers of monopolies. Over the years, versions of her game circulated, eventually reaching Darrow during the Great Depression. He saw an opportunity, refined the game, and started selling handmade sets. In fact, it was him that added features such as the jail, community chests, and chance cards. By 1935, he struck a deal with Parker Brothers, and the game took off. It quickly became one of the best-selling board games of all times, with millions of players buying, selling, and bankrupting their friends and family. Today, Monopoly is sold in over 100 countries with countless themed editions, including one I just saw from the news article where they're having it now app-based that can do all the counting for you and do all the money for you. So it's a great Monopoly for those who don't know how to count. All right, that's all I have for you guys today. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. But until then, my name is Matthew Bishop, and you've heard The Full Story. Bye.